Hello, coffee makers, not coffee takers. I am Dr. Joseph J. Burt Miller Jr., and I'm one half of the Cyber Coffee Hour, along with Alfredo B. Nash Jr. We're two cybersecurity experts from Mount Vernon, New York, sharing with you our experiences in this field and also the experiences of others so we all can learn, elevate, and ultimately realize we all belong in this space. The views, opinions, and thoughts are of the Cyber Coffee Hour and not those of our employers or personal or professional relationships. So for today's show, we're going to discuss the importance of the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, or CMMC 2.0, in protecting sensitive information. And to help me break this all down, I have a special guest, Senior Master Sergeant Cade Forrester of the United States Air Force, as he joins the Cyber Coffee Hour for this conversation. Now, Senior Master Sergeant Cade Forrester is a graduate student in the Department of Defense Management at the Naval Postgraduate School, Monterey, California. He is pursuing his MBA in Contracts Management. Sergeant Forrester enlisted in the Air Force in November 2009. He graduated from technical training in March 2010 and began his career in material management before retraining in contracts management in 2015. Sergeant Forrester's diverse background includes leadership and technician roles within supply chain management, plans and programs, and services contracting. He has been deployed to the Horn of Africa and supported numerous other contingencies, including Operations Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, Freedom Sentinel, Resolute Support, and Inherent Resolve. Before being competitively selected for Naval Postgraduate School, Sergeant Forrester was the Section Chief of the Infrastructure Flight at the 11th Contracting Squadron, Joint Base Anacostia Bowling, Washington, D.C., where he and his team supported the first lead service transfer in Department of Defense history. Senior Master Sergeant Cade Forrester, welcome to the Cyber Coffee Hour.
Hey, that was a lot of stuff to say, man.
Hey, man. I was muscling through that thing. I was like, man, it's like three pages long, man.
That's the best part of my shoes is I'm able to write it, not read it.
Nah, but it's all good, man. And glad to have you on the show.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. So let's get right to it. So article that we want to discuss tonight, it's titled "The U.S. Just Got Serious About Cybersecurity. Contractors Are Not Ready." This is authored by Mr. Eric Noonan, dated back November 3rd, 2023. So I'll start off with a bit of an excerpt from the article. So the federal government's hands are more than full in monitoring multiple wars overseas and an election cycle just ahead. Amid these urgent conflicts, the leaders of the Five Eyes recently sat for an unprecedented interview with 60 Minutes, calling the People's Republic of China the defining threat of this generation. The first public appearance of America's English-speaking intelligence alliance at a time of great unrest abroad speaks volumes about the importance of protecting sensitive information in cyberspace. In recent months, U.S. agencies were breached by Chinese hackers who stole 60,000 State Department emails in their data hall, and we know defense intelligence is targeted as well. In many cases, companies that hold such intelligence aren't aware of their own role in national security. So before we go any further, I'll stop right there. I just want to get your initial thoughts, Cade, on this as, like, I guess, what are the first things that come to mind when you hear this?
Hey, a song that's being sung a lot in the Air Force right now is China, China, China. Mm-hmm. The whole entire Department of Defense is getting serious about China, who kind of slid underneath the covers a lot, and then now has stood up and showed their true colors as a great, great power competition. So first initial thoughts on this article is nothing new, right? We have always been looking at cybersecurity when it comes to contracting. It's nothing new, right. But the only thing, it puts a lot more stringent on it. You could ask for a lot. We could definitely say, contractor, you have to meet such requirements, but how do you implement that? And how do you oversee that? And how do you monitor that? That's where the issue lies. And this article brings up the policy, but it's the implication piece that we still lack and where we have a lot of struggling right now. Because from a business perspective, right, I as a government could demand X, Y, Z, but as a contractor, that's gonna put a hindrance in my pocket. The more you ask for is the more that I have to provide. And as such, I'm going to try to bill you for that accordingly. So it comes a question of how do you balance this? Do you want more data protection? Are you willing to pay for more data protection? Or are you willing to take a lower cost for more risk? It's just a matter of risk. So it's a huge deal. But on the top level, it's all about risk. What risk are you willing to take? And what risk are you willing to mitigate?
And a couple of things that come to mind for me and what I took from it, I kind of broke it down to like five key aspects. So looking at it from a geopolitical challenge or even security concern of it, you know, with the federal government facing, you know, challenges, you know, trying to monitor many different priorities, including multiple overseas wars. And also now with the election cycles really ramping up, you know, as you mentioned, with China being the focus, I think China's really putting themselves as the major threat of this current generation. Yes. Of course, we've had other nation state actors and still to this day, but I think China's really almost kind of making their way as a real, superpower, if that's correct to say, in that regard.
Absolutely. And then they've been doing it for years, but a lot of it has gone unnoticed, especially in contracting specifically. For the past years, our Air Force contracting leadership, I was trying to bring it up to Congress that, hey, look, it takes us this long to take a project from conception to execution. There's no data out there how long it takes China to do that. So that unknown itself is pretty large. And look at it this way, like, we're one of the greatest developers of new technology, and China's one of the greatest thieves of new technology.
So, right.
Yes. We could put all of our power to it. All these come right behind and hack us and try to take that same technology itself. So it comes that battle of how do you produce, not only produce it, but how do you protect it? Because it comes a copycat scheme, hence all of the mimicking. Because if you look at all of our new technology, all of our new platforms, they have a similar version of everything.
Yes. So it's almost like a bootleg. They got the bootleg version of it.
Specifically. And their economy kind of drives on that, because overall in the country, it is illegal for them to do the copycat. All the knockoffs you see is pretty much illegal in the country, except for specific regions, because only specific regions of the country is authorized to actually do worldwide trade.
And kind of looking at it from a, cybersecurity perspective, you know, as you highlighted about the over 60K emails being compromised, that even more so pushes the need for more, you know, robust cybersecurity implementation measures, laws, what have you. Because it's almost like every day, I mean, there's always a new, we hear about it in the news, a new breach, you know, and these are like not small companies. We're talking about big, well-established, known, like I said, organizations, companies. And so it's almost getting to the point where you're almost numb to it at this point. Now it's just, okay, who is it this time?
It becomes the norm. So basically it's warfare. There's a book written years ago by a couple of Chinese officers called Unrestricted Warfare, where they basically laid it out. If they're going to attack America, how would they do it? And they captured informational warfare, technological warfare, and economic warfare. Example of that, when the oil industry got hit on the East Coast, that nearly crippled our logistics. This is nothing new to stuff that they actually captured in that book. So the whole hacking is all warfare.
Right.
So warfare nowadays, it's a modern era. It's not only bullets and boots on the ground. It is all the background stuff that's been going on. And China is, they've been doing it for a while now. And it's costly.
Yeah. And I just want to get your thoughts. So when we're talking about as far as like the national security implications, so given that, you know, defense intelligence is always going to be a main target as when we're talking about cyber attacks. Mm-hmm. When we have that interconnectedness, which of government agencies and also private companies, now there isn't like a blanket I guess security measure, I guess, for all agencies, whether private sector or government. Especially when we look at private sector, some agencies or some companies, they may not have such a great or detailed cybersecurity team, or they may not have the means to have maybe a large team to protect that data. So when you're talking about maybe private sector companies that may hold like a sensitive information, I think that really underscores the need for a more collaborative approach between the government and the private sector to address these type of vulnerabilities that continue to exist and can't seem to get a good handle on that, because there's not the same, like you said, you have the government has this standard and then private sector has this standard, and they're not meeting at the same wavelength.
So it's hard for both parties to meet in the middle, right? From the industry standard, you're going to do bare minimum, because why? The less you spend, the higher your revenue. But from the government perspective, we're looking at it from a national security threat. We're going to ask for heightened security to protect certain data. But it comes a web that goes all the way down. So the government may be doing business with company A, but company A sources parts from company B, C, D, all the way down to Z. And right. Each company within their supply chain creates another vulnerability. And then the further on you go, you may end up in a mom and pop shop. They're not going to have any cybersecurity.
No.
And they're just going to put that individual piece and whatever technology they put into it can become hackable. Example of this, one of my coworkers out here, they use the cake as an example for S-bombs. You are buying a piece of software, right? You're buying a cake. Unless you know each individual ingredients, you don't know if you're allergic. You don't know if nuts are in there and you're going to pass out and die.
Right.
And that's how it is, especially when it comes to software, because you're building bits and pieces. And a lot of it is open source, so you can easily embed something. And then as a private company, you're going to take that S-bomb and put it into another project, which already could create some vulnerability. We ran into this years back, which created a lot of security, a lot of justification around telecommunication, because they found out products from certain Chinese companies were already came hacked and already had bugs in them and creating a vulnerability for us. But at the end of the day, it comes down to a matter of risk, right? I can require as a government contractor to do XYZ, but then that's just going to cost me more money. Am I going to request the same level of risk when I'm buying the simple things as a couple thousand books?
Yeah.
But it could still create a vulnerability. So it's coming to say, how do you justify that piece? So it's a high level of risk.
Right. And I think there's another element too, when we're talking about for private sector, I think there's a lack of awareness as it pertains to the private sector of like what it is that they're a lack of awareness of their exact role as it pertains to national security. Yes, there, as you mentioned, some of these cybersecurity teams may not be as robust, and and they become easy targets for an attacker to really could, as opposed to going to the government, they have more established cybersecurity teams. But they look down that supply chain and okay, this mom and pop organization, they only got one person doing all this cybersecurity, and they know that's not going to hold up. So I mean, do you feel that's even more prevalent, or have, or maybe I don't know if you may have seen it, but maybe you've heard of it as it pertains to like when it comes to private sector organizations just. Yes, they know that they may be guarding like say like a power grid, but maybe they're not fully aware of like the real consequences if something was to happen to the organization.
I think it's two part, right? Bigger companies, they are fully aware of the necessity of the critical role that they play as gatekeepers.
Right.
Smaller companies may not. They're just still thinking of the traditional view of business e-commerce. And the other side of it is, so for me personally, I think they don't want to know about the vulnerability.
Mm.
Because if you know about that vulnerability, then you have to take certain actions. Because what these requirements were levying on them is a justification, or I should say a certification. I am certifying that I meet this level. I am certifying the product that I provide meets this standard. But if you dig deep enough and do enough research, not even the treasury level of your supply chain, go all the way down, 100 levels down, you may find something that you don't like, which will require you to take action. So that's it to me, it comes down to a situation to where, yes, some private companies are aware, they will take actions at to a certain level.
Right.
But for them to go fully in depth, it's going to be way too costly and way too risky.
So, yeah. And I think that's really calls for like more proactive measures to really enhance cybersecurity, you know, at both, yeah, both government and our private sector levels. You know, when we talk about trying to increase our vigilance, implementation of some more stricter, mandatory cybersecurity standards or protocols, an effort to bridge that gap, as we just mentioned, you know, between government and private sector, to understand that, hey, private sector company, you are, what you're guarding or what you're in charge of is pretty important. Like, we gotta make sure that you're beefing up your security team. If you don't have a sufficient team or the resources, you know, let us know how we can help to make sure.
But a big issue with that is, how do you verify that, right? That's going to take the government actually go in and investigate. And that when you go in and investigate, that costs you time, money, and schedule. All three that we rarely have enough of. And then more so with contracts, the buyer, we have privity of supply chain, not privity of contract with the subcontractors. So there's nothing mandating, unless I put it in the contract explicitly, that they have to give me certain access to their subcontractors. All I have is access to where the supply chain is coming from to a certain level.
So do you feel private sector companies, as you said earlier, they don't want to know like the full realm of what they're in charge of? So you think that the reason for that is because they just don't have the money to do that? Because they know if they money, resources, where the case is, they like once they become fully aware of what it is that they have or what they need to do, like, hey, this might put me out of business. I don't know if I can do all this or meet that standard that the government wants me to do. So they may cut corners or, you know, just so that they don't have to, like I said, meet certain standards, because they know it may not be cost effective for them. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. That's definitely one case. And that's what I personally think is happening. But if we really want, like I was saying, if we really want them to find out all the way down, that's the cost that they're going to pass off to the government. That's not cost they're going to eat on their own.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So put it on the government, not the...
Yeah. So if they want to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars, they want to go out there and say, we are all for national security, by all means, there's nothing stopping them from doing that. But who's going to do that? Who's going to openly spend all that money just to say that they could do that, when they could just do the bare minimum and meet the requirements?
Right.
So that's what comes in that battle. Like, this article is great. It's a good first step. It is saying that this is the policy. This is what we require of you. But it has no teeth. It has no ramification, no how are we going to monitor it? So that's something you find regular with policies.
Yeah, no sense of consequence, huh?
Yeah, not only that, how are we going to justify this thing? Because this all comes down to the contractor certification. They're going there and saying, hey, I meet XYZ.
So kind of going back to a bit of the article. So, yeah, so nearly a decade ago, the Department of Defense introduced the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement, or DFARS. As a security framework to protect the nation's intellectual property. So despite being included in over a million contracts, DFARS has been largely unenforced. Until now, the DoD set to release the CMMC in November. But again, this article is dated back in November, so it's January now. So it should be out already, I believe. And that document is supposed to signal a shift towards enforcement to ensure that a defense industrial base prioritizes protecting sensitive information. So the proposed rule aims to introduce a crucial enforcement mechanism, moving away from the previous system where contractors could self-certify their implementation of required security controls, emphasizing a transition from a trust-based to a verify-based approach. And I'll stop there and want to hear your thoughts when I mention that, and also with that new CMMC rule.
Yeah, so from our role, I haven't got any verification or any information on that, how to do the verification piece yet. It may be out there. You just haven't made it onto my level as of yet, how they plan to do that. But how it's written as of now, it's basically saying when we put a project out for requirement, we're going to put that clause in there requiring the contractor to have a certain level, a certain CMC level.
Right.
And if they don't have that level, then they're not eligible for the award. That is how it currently stands right now in the DFAR. So that could be one level of how we're monitoring it, is to say if you don't meet it requirements, then you're not eligible at all for that project.
So and again, I guess based off the previous rule, so let's say an organization does try to apply to meet that that certification level, and let's say, as you mentioned, a scenario they don't meet it, what will be the next steps that organization can do? Like, is there a waiting period, you know, after they don't meet it, let's say like 6 months before they can try again? Or I guess how does that work?
See, that piece I don't know. I'd have to look that up and get back to you with that.
Okay, no problem. All right. Kind of going back into this. So Microsoft warns of increase in nation state threats, especially from Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, utilizing new vectors like Discord to target critical infrastructure. So with over 300,000 contractors in the defense industrial base, there's a significant risk of hackers stealing military secrets. The call of defense contractors to meet mandatory cybersecurity minimums is crucial, but a study by Merrill Research reveals a compliance gap. And I found this interesting. So they say only 36% of contractors submitted required compliance scores, down from the previous year. The average score among submitters was negative 15, far from the total compliance score of 110. Contractors exhibit selectivity in compliance, with only 90% implementing vulnerability management solutions and 25% having secure IT backup solutions, basic cybersecurity staples. Additionally, 40% go beyond legal requirements by explicitly denying the use of, I'm going to jack this up, Huawei. Designated a national security risk by the Federal Communications Commission. I find that intriguing. Like, I guess why so much of these subpar numbers?
So I'm thinking this is coming from Section 889 requirement, which dropped down in 2019-2020 time frame, because that one brand you mentioned, the butcher the name again, Huawei.
Yeah.
They're amongst several other Chinese companies, telecommunication companies. They're the ones, right, who they found the actual bug devices. So long story short, we bought some devices, and after years, we found they came pre-bug. So as a requirement, Section 89 requires that anytime we purchase an item, we need a certification from that contractor. It doesn't matter what we buy. We could be buying pens. We could buy an aircraft. We could buy lotion. It doesn't matter what. We need that certification.
Oh, so it doesn't need to be like electronics, or it could be just anything.
Anything. We need that certification, but the main thing we're targeting is electronics. And that certification says a couple things. One, we're looking for them to say, A, we do not have any of those, the listed brands in, right, our production facility or anywhere at all. Or two, that those specific brands were not used in the production of the item that we're buying or service that we're buying. So it's a two-parter. One, they didn't use it to produce the item we're buying. And two, they don't use that item at all in your facility.
But, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, but there's other parts to it too. So that's the front end.
Right.
The way it's written is kind of vague, because they do allow companies that use those items to still sell us products. So there's other justifications on it as well. So there's another part where they can say they do use those items in those facilities, but they weren't used specifically to produce this item.
Okay. So it doesn't just automatically, you know, rule them out if they do declare that they do.
No, there's a couple of stipulations. As with everything, you know, policy drops and then it gets redone. Yeah. It got redone several times in the next few months. So one thing I heard, the reason for that is some of our major defense contractors internationally, they use some of those brands in their international facilities. So the way it was initially written as a black and white, they would be banned from doing business with the government.
So, and that's very interesting. So let's say when an organization declares to say, you know, yeah, we don't use XYZ products. Is there any sort of follow-up or verification to say, I mean, do we just go solely by what an organization declares, or they take that and, but they'll verify at some point or do some audit later on to make sure that they're doing what they said they are?
Nope. Once we get that verification, we have met that policy requirements. But then, however, for larger projects, for large scale, like say a weapon system, aircraft, new missile,
right,
we do have the authority to go in and investigate that as well. However, you're not going to see that at a lower level operational. You're not going to see someone jumping in there to go verify the production plan if you're buying a couple hundred laptops. That's going to cost more money.
Yeah, more money, more time. So I'm assuming you just go on from that. It had to be quite selective, as you know, for the ones that you do want to follow up on or prioritize. I'd say ones you wanted to.
Most definitely. So I have coworkers who have worked the major defense projects, such as folks on the F-22 project, and they mentioned that they did go in and further investigate that. They sent the team in to do a deep dive in the production facility to see everything that they have on hand. But it comes down to that risk mitigation. What risk are you willing to mitigate, and what risk are you willing to take?
Do you know how long those audits normally take, I guess, on average?
No, not off the top of my head. But what I do know, we do have an agency specifically that does contract management, DCMA, they will have folks embedded in the facility that continuously do that.
Okay.
So that's for bigger projects.
Right. All right.
So off the top though, that Section 889 from operational level, I'll tell you this much, man, it was a pain.
Oh yeah.
Why
is that?
Small transaction, you could be spending $500. And you're requiring that extra work.
So something small as that, you got to put in. Working OT for
small little items that are non-telecommunication related, you have to do it. And it creates a hindrance in e-commerce as well. Because as an organization, we're shifting a lot more to e-commerce for our commercial practices to be more like the commercial realm, not requiring extra work, which extra work requires extra costs.
Right.
So it took us a couple months to actually find ways to work around that. Like, for example, we have an Amazon business for the government. And the way they worked around that, they uploaded those 889 certifications for those companies. So instead of contracting officers having to go out and contact each company individually, they could go on there, add an item to their shopping cart, just like they would in regular Amazon, and then download the already pre-signed 889. But it took some time for us to get to that level.
Oh, so it's almost like, I think you could do that on Amazon now, where you can do like I mean, it's pretty much like a shopping list. Like you can have a saved list, and so it already has the items that you want to, and you could create it to where it may be a certain project or wherever it is, you could build something out. Say, hey, I'm building my home lab, and these are the items I need, and they're all in that list and all the prices. So it sounds like something similar to that.
Yeah. So contracting as a whole, we're going more e-commerce as much as possible for your regular sustainment. And for cyber specifically, to bring it back to that, we have a list of trusted vendors, an approved vendor list that we source from. So we're not just going out and you're willy-nilly getting cyber items.
Right.
But it comes back down to the full circle, right? We're buying the cake. Very, for operational side, we very few time focused on all the ingredients and all of the smaller S-bombs that relate to it, and dive down to those S-bombs within the S-bombs to find out what's the source of it, right?
Right. Oh man, that's I could definitely see how that can, you know, when you're really spending time, and as you mentioned, using the cake example and looking at looking at every single ingredient. Yes, you get the project, or you know, the cake in a sense, but the time it takes to extrapolate and look at every single ingredient and tying it back, and they're all going to come from different locations, you know, different vendors, what have you, and to really track all that down. Yeah, it can be very time consuming, and also, you know, time is money. So you know, also need the resources, the proper resources for those to carry out those checks. I could see how that can be really take up time.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking on it. There are companies who are specialized in that currently, and some of them are actually trying to work with government to create a team to help the government with cybersecurity, specifically with their supply chain issues. Two of them, Flex, formerly Flextronics, and Reslink, they specialize in that supply chain risk management piece. So Flex, they do everything, right? They're a huge component for the COVID response for the DoD as well. But they have a system out there that they provide their customers to where if a situation happens anywhere around the world, they can tap in to see what supply chain will be affected, right? So companies like that, for any major company who's doing business with the government, they could use them to source their parts and actually create supply chain transparency, because they will know exactly where every single part comes from, where it's being sourced from. But again, it comes down to that cost.
So, and how long, I'm assuming the government is looking to really expand out in that regard, to have those partnerships to help, like, as you mentioned, these type of tasks, they can get, like I said, quite costly and very time consuming. But if you have that partnership and I'd say even maybe even alliance to help with those, some of those tasks, like I said, that could definitely speed up the process. But like from your, I guess for what you wanted to share, do you know if there's like more companies that they're looking to try to partner with in that regard to help kind of when it comes to that process to try to speed things up or make it more efficient?
So I don't know off the top of my head if any other companies are involved, but I know for those two specifically, they're working in tiger teams with the government to help them in that aspect. So I've had the pleasure of working with both of them in my time out here at the Naval Postgraduate School. And I had access to some of their software, and it's pretty eye opening. It's pretty eye opening.
Wow. Okay. So just kind of finishing up this article here. So having been part of the decision making process, the industry is now urged to take action by implementing security controls to enhance the protection of national secrets. So the call emphasizes holding defense contractors to the same security standards expected from tech giants like Microsoft and Google, implementing the cybersecurity maturity model certification, again, CMMC 2.0, is essential for safeguarding sensitive defense information, national security assets, which have been at risk for far too long. So highlighting the aggressive exploitation of vulnerabilities by adversaries like China, you know, that this article emphasizes that defense contractors must embrace the longstanding requirements embedded in their contracts and fully implement mandatory minimum cybersecurity standards. So the Department of Defense has set an effective date for compliance standards, signaling a critical juncture for contractors to fulfill their commitment to cybersecurity. And again, this article underscores the vital role of defense contractors in maintaining American technological superiority and protecting military secrets, urging them to validate their commitment through the public-private partnership vision of CMMC 2.0 and achieving certification. I guess, yeah, Kate, I guess last thoughts on this as we close this article out.
So last thoughts, this is a good step forward, right? Holding contractors responsible, making sure they understand that they're doing their part. However, the implementation is where we're going to have to get it right. If we implement this policy too hard, we may drive contractors away from doing business with the government. We need them as much as they need us, right? where right. we have to work them in a partnership. And if we drive too soft, then it becomes one of those pods where we just check the box. So in the implementation piece, we need to find the right median to where both parties are happy. Because in this business, we need a win-win situation. And both right. parties are willing to come to the table to give best value. However, at the same time, we need to put flexibility. That flexibility is the key to AirPar, right? We yep. need flexibility to some level to where, depending on what the project is, depending on the risk mitigation that we need to take, we can implement a higher level versus for a lower project, quick and easy, 15 days is done and completed. We can do it to a bare minimum. So that'll be my suggestion on it is find the median, find the flexibility.
Good stuff, man. I like it. This was good. I definitely enjoyed it. I learned some stuff from you just going through that, and for you to even share and tying in your experiences with the Air Force. I thought that was pretty interesting. So yeah, definitely thank you for that.
Yeah, the big part I'll add to it too is not necessarily cyber, but I was saving this part to the end, is the supply chain management part of it. So this may seem upfront that it's a cyber requirement, but it's more so a supply chain management requirement. Right? You and I have a contract, brother, right?
Right.
I guarantee you, I'm going to give you the cyber requirement that you request at a higher level. But like we were talking about earlier, mom and pop that I work with, that my cousin works with, that his cousin, his cousin, his cousin, his cousin work with.
Right.
They don't care about that.
No.
And we've had situations, especially recently in the Air Force, where we got deformed parts because from way down the line through contracts, somebody put that part in the system that was not conforming to standards. So it's how do you control your supply chain management? I know it's cyber, but it's still supply chain management all around.
No, absolutely. Absolutely, man. Well, thank you. So now at this point of the show, we're gonna change focus strictly to you, sir. Strictly to you. This is the hot seat. No, I just wanted to learn more about you. You know what? I thought you looked familiar, man. I could have sworn maybe I seen you around in my travels.
I was that dude in uniform while you were rocking all those fly suits. Back in Nebraska. Just because I wear the same thing every day. You had to wear a different suit every day to rub it in.
Oh, man. Nah, that I thought that was... And you know what? Well, when I watch everyone, I guess the military members, it always brought back of course my time in the Air Force, and I was like, man, I kind of want to get back in the uniform. So it's funny you say that, and in my mind, I'm like, man, I want to be back in the uniform again. So, it was cool, man. It was definitely great working with you. I think it'll be definitely a treat just to. Not so much for me, but also really just for our listeners, just learn a little bit more about you and of course everything that you do and what made Cade, you know. So
absolutely.
Let me see. What obstacles you'd say you've had to overcome to get to where you are today?
I mean, so obstacles is a word that I look at differently, right? One of my old mentors, he put it to me where it's not an obstacle, it's not a defeat, it's a learning opportunity.
Mm.
You know, it becomes an obstacle or defeat or failure based on how you respond. If you let it kill you down or if you bounce back from it, right? So certain ones that I came up with, even before I joined the Air Force, the reason why I joined the Air Force, I had a full ride to college up at Ramapo College in North Jersey. But then they found out my mom was in the country illegally. And because of that, that triggered me to enlist to get my citizenship expedited so that way I could gain her green card. So a lot of people view that as an obstacle, but for me, that was an opportunity because that led me down this career. It's one of the best things that ever happened to me. It led me to join the Air Force where I found my way. I joined for personal reasons, right? Citizenship. And I think I'm going to get my college degree and dip out. But I fell in love with the camaraderie. Fell in love with the ability to help others and meet great individuals like you. Every day is another opportunity to do something better, right? And then so for me, that's one of the biggest obstacle, or should I say learning opportunity, that I had to overcome.
So as you mentioned that, you know, I'd say what I take from that, you know, as you mentioned, your mother not having the green card, and you enlisted so that way you can get the citizenship. So I guess, Lena, before that became a thought, like, I guess, do you know where you were? I guess mentally, as far as, you know, like, did you see yourself as being like in the military before that happened? I know that's kind of circumstance, but was that something?
Definitely
you
put some thought to it. My older cousin, Regula, like brother, my role model, he actually enlisted in the Marines before that.
Mm.
So I already had that affiliation with it. And I was planning to pursue aeronautical engineering. So the Air Force did come to mind with that. All right. Okay. That's something from my childhood days from back in Jamaica. It was like aeronautical engineering. They make a lot of money. Planes. That sounds cool.
Oh, man. So, all right. So you touched on Jamaica. What part of Jamaica you came from?
So I come from St. Elizabeth, the Southwest region. St. Elizabeth, the area they call it breadbasket of Jamaica. Mostly known for grown produce.
Yeah. You know, that's crazy you say that, man. My father, he's from there, St. Elizabeth.
That's why.
From Kingston.
That's why I knew something about you I like, man.
Nah, that's cool, man. That's cool.
So you're talking about Jamaica. That's one thing that's Cade right there, right? I have it tattooed on me. That is one of the main motivator I have to why I cannot fail and I will not fail. It's that pride in my upbringing, that pride in my community that I'm from. Because growing up wasn't easy, you know. The community bonded around every single child there to grow them. So, like, me and all my cousins, all my peers of our age group, we have that we owe them. We have that debt to our community. So we have no other choice but to do great stuff with our lives so that way they could celebrate us. And then we just bring it back to the community as well and reinvest in the future.
Absolutely, man. And I got to bring it up. I see this lovely sign in the backdrop there. I see you got the Jamaica flag / Air Force. Can you share the history on that?
Yeah, so it's made out of plywood. So one of my mentees, she was thinking about getting out of the Air Force. I had some rough Air Force career, bad supervisors in the past. Right. And I was able to work with her, find out what motivates her and kind of develop her, grow her to the point where she's a superstar now, man. She went from being viewed at like the bottom of her units, which came to the new unit. Now she's out there. She's out there kicking butt. People are asking for her to work for them. So it was a surprise to me, right? I'm not doing this for recognition. It was just what I enjoy doing, developing folks, seeing who has potential and aptitude and help them out. And so one day I just got this in the mail, like poof, big old box. And it was really touching. It was really touching to get that out of the blue.
Did you cry?
No, I didn't cry. I just took a few drinks.
that's nice though. It looks really good.
It's one of those small things that is a reminder to keep on the right track, right? Very, very often in life, you don't get those good jobs. Well, you don't need those good jobs, but when you get them, it really means a lot.
Absolutely. And I guess kind of touch on that, as you mentioned, you know, your mentee giving you that gift as a show of appreciation. Like how important do you feel mentoring is for anyone, whether in the Air Force, you know, working their way up in cybersecurity or any field? Like how much stock do you put into the importance of mentorship?
A lot. So the biggest misconception is you need a mentor.
Mm.
I want to debunk that. You need mentors, and crap, they don't even have to know that they're your mentor. You just gotta go to them, pull that bit of information, pull that good juju that you want from them, right?
Right.
So it took me a while to realize that I had mentors without even noticing, because there was folks who I would go to, as folks who I would look to for certain items, and just not even asking them, just by watching them, I'll get the answer, I get the response that I need, and I'll get the motivation I need for my career. So by having mentors, it was huge, because early in my career, I was just a workaholic, right?
Right.
I was very task-oriented, which led me to a bad path. I was getting a job done. I was managing teams. but I was not managing people. And it wasn't until I started looking at mentors that I understand that you need to absolutely take care of people as well. So that led me to become a mentor to others and value my prior mentors. I went back and look out to them. One of the first one I had about a year in the Air Force, I got in some trouble, right? And one of my peers actually came in on their day off to do something for me that projected my career from upward from their BTZ below the zone promotion. And it wasn't until years later that I looked back and I realized that was the first mentor I ever had. And I reached out to her years later, like, hey, listen, I know it took me years, but that small action that you took, it showed me something different. So with that being said, especially any realm, any cyber, regardless where you are you having that mentor who put that little effort in you, right, and you realize that effort is being put into you, it motivates you to do something better because you build that sense of commitment, right?
Right.
Because somebody took that time to invest in you, so you don't want to let that person down. So that's the first part about a mentor. And then the mentors now, you look for that little bit, that little attribute from each individual. He's pretty good at public speaking. I'm going to go listen to him speak. And then if I have a question, hey, why did you talk about that? I chose that topic because of XYZ. Jot that down, put it into my toolkit. So he didn't know that he just mentored me on that a little bit. Can I use it today? No. But in 2 years, I'm going to pull my toolkit out and pull a little tidbit that he gave me. Absolutely. So that's why I'm a big fan of mentors, because not one person is perfect. Your mentor could be the worst supervisor there is ever. But I'm a proud believer that your best supervisor in the Air Force is your worst one, because you know what not to do.
Exactly. Yep. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah.
I always believe that you can learn, you know, from good leadership and bad leadership. Just for that same reason, you know, when it comes to the bad leadership, you know, because you know how it made you feel being on the receiving end of it. So it's like, okay, I know I don't want to be like him, or I don't want to be like her, because I know how it made me feel. So, yeah, I mean, same thing, you know, and I believe, you know, we have mentors that come into our lives for a season. You know, we may not even keep up with them for the rest of our lives, but we have the right people that enter our lives and they impart some knowledge into us that help us get through that part, you know, of our careers, our lives, whatever the case is. And that's something we can carry and then share that same information in turn when we have our own mentees that are trying to make their way. We could share, you know, as you mentioned, having a toolkit. You're taking bits and pieces from everything that you've learned along your career and be able to share that knowledge for those that are coming up behind us. So, you know, I think that's great. That's great info, great intel for folks listening. All right, hard-hitting question for you. I hope you're ready for this. What is your favorite coffee that gets you through the day?
All right, it's going to disappoint a lot, right? I have zero standards when it comes to coffee, right? Zero standards. I just hate Starbucks because it just tastes burnt and awful. If it's between Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts, I'm gonna go Dunkin' Donuts all day. On a regular basis, I'll drink Summit, the Costco Keurig brand.
Okay. But
on a good day, especially just for you, I have some Blue Mountain, Jamaican. Whoa. Blue Mountain coffee.
Okay. You know, my father gonna love that. Nice, man. And I like the Guinness mug too. Yep. Put that back in it. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, it's not just coffee in here. It's big enough so you can put out the stuff.
Oh man, good stuff. So just outside, of course, you know, within the confines of work, like what do you do to recharge? Like, what are, you know, some hobbies, activities you like to get into? You know, are you Xbox, PlayStation guy? You like to play ball? Like what do you do to relieve stress?
For the past year and a half, I've been learning how to have a life again. Because it's sad, but I've been going so hard for so long. It's nothing but work and the little time I have spending with the family. So there was no life. What I do though, prior to now is always lawn work and drives, right? Lawn work as part of my American dream. I wanted not a white picket fence, but a green lawn. So yeah. Every house that I bought, my dream was to always bring the lawn back to life. And it was peaceful. It's just me out there in my grass. Most time I'm out there barefoot, feeling the twinkles in my toe. Nobody comes to bother you. The wife doesn't come out there. Kids doesn't come out there because they don't want to help you do the lawn work. So it's
of course not. You kidding me?
It's just you, music, and the lawn. You just zone out because it helps with anxiety, because I developed anxiety over the years of always thinking about work, which led to insomnia. And just the lawn work helps that severely. And the other thing I got into is just driving. I always drive a manual. I have to drive a manual. Just the mere fact of changing gears, being entwined with the car, feeling the car, it helps me zone out where my mind is at ease. I'm not thinking about work. I'm just look down and out of nowhere, I'm in sixth gear. I don't even remember getting all the way up there.
It's just all muscle memory at that point.
Yeah, you just zone out. Put your mind at ease.
So I'm sure when you're on those long drives, I know you're listening to some music. What are some of your top artists, or what's currently on the playlist right now? If we were to look at the playlist,
depends on what day, right? If I had like a crappy day, I'll do some Moonlight Sonata, some take my mind off of it, or some Tropical House. That's what I listen to a lot of. Something where you're not necessarily going to be diving into the words. It's just a melody to keep your mind at ease. Working out, running, EDM. If I'm in a good mood, I'll do some dancehall reggae. Something to keep the vibes up.
Yeah.
But mainly those. And then every now and then, I'll get in a lovey-dovey mood for some country music.
Country? Whoa. Oh, all right. Who's your top country artist? Do you have any favorites?
I grew up on a Kenny Rogers. That was always playing in my household growing up. So
Kenny, okay.
The old schools are always still there. But the one band I really like now, just for one song, is Little Town Road. I think that's what they call Wine, Beer, and Whiskey.
Oh, Wine, Beer, and Whiskey. Okay.
Yeah.
I have to say I've not heard that one, so I'll definitely have to do a search on that. But that's cool. I think that's interesting. Like for me, like sometimes I'll listen to, I have to be honest, I don't even really listen to like the current hip hop as much, because I don't even know what they're saying anymore. But but yeah, I'll definitely listen, of course, you know, some reggae, dancehall. When it comes to reggae, it's been a lot of like the old school reggae. So I definitely listen to a lot of Barris Hammond, Gregory Isaacs, you know, and just kind of go from there, just mixing on that. But if I'm reading, you know, if I want that quiet serenity to where I could have that focus, I listen to some classical, just some whether, you know, Mozart or even really stumbled upon this. Well, I can't even say he's new. He's new to me. His last name is Baptiste. I think he just has a recent show. I think it's on Hulu. I think John Baptiste. I hope I'm messing up his name. If I got it messed up, I'll fix it in the show notes. But his work is pretty good too. So I try to keep a wide range, of music.
Check out Tropical House, man. It's right up that alley.
Tropical House? Okay. Yeah.
You're going to think you're on a beach with a hookah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll definitely add it to the list. All right. Well, sir, it's been a pleasure.
Hey, and there's one more thing, Joseph. I just came to mind. So
sure.
I know you hit me up with that question about challenge that I face or obstacle. Yeah. One of the one that comes to mind is officer training school, right? So I'm an enlisted member, been in 14 years now. So I applied for officer training school before, didn't get picked up. Went another round before, didn't get picked up as well. And I kind of gave up on it, that goal, right? For viewers who don't understand, there's two sides of the Air Force or military. You have the enlisted and you have the officers. Right. So back in Victorian era, the officers were from the high breeds. They were the aristocrats and enlisted were peasants. So that's way back, but it's still structured in that manner. But a funny thing nowadays, in a lot of career fields, the enlisted members are more educated than the officers. So long story short, applied a few times, didn't get picked up. And it was a beater because that's the only thing I went for in my career that I didn't achieve, that I wholeheartedly put everything into, checked all the boxes, played the game. It came to a point where I had to decide whether it was me or whether it was the process. So that was the obstacle, right? That was the beater. Is it going to beat me or is there something wrong with me? And that led me to a lot of folks, a lot of mentors. I had to say, hey, man, nothing tried, nothing done. So instead of sitting down and let it become a defeat, I had to respond, let it be a lesson learned of humility and apply again. And I got picked up for it. So it comes back like that full circle of lessons learned. And it's all about how you respond.
Wow. Well, first, congrats, man. And definitely, you know, having that persistence and knowing that's what you want and not giving up. So definitely, big credit to you. That's major.
So that if we go full circle, you know, a lot of folks started to sit back and said, hey, because of my skin tone, you can't do X, Y, Z. There's a lot of opportunities out there. What we fail and what we always end up doing is we get in a mindset of being defeated before you even try, right?
Yeah, that defeatist mindset. Yeah.
If you go for the opportunity and you wholeheartedly will go in, check all the boxes, play the game, do what you need to do to achieve that, and you don't get picked up, then you become a situation where you have to try again. But if you just sit back and accept defeat without even trying, then you can't complain at all.
Right.
Because when I moved to the U.S., I moved to Paterson, New Jersey. And I graduated from Eastside High, where they made that movie off of Morgan Freeman. Brand new immigrant. I'm getting tear gassed. And security guard hides in the corner because they got DEA in there. You got undercovers and
be able to.
But what that school set me up for is it set me up to show that you can still rise from anything, right? So now when I go anywhere and I share that I went to that school and had to go through 3 metal detectors, it creates that thought that it doesn't matter where you come from. It's all about your aptitude. It's all about your attitude, and it's all about your commitment.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely a mentality, you know, that you have to possess, you know, regardless of, you know, situation, you know, environment. If you know that's something that you, whatever goal that you set forth for yourself and you know, you want to achieve it or you need to achieve it, you're not going to let anything else stop you. You know, you, and it's not to say you won't stumble, you won't fail, but, you know, I think part of that is that learning piece, as you mentioned, you know, okay, this didn't work. I'm gonna make some adjustments and try again. You just keep going till you get it. You can't let, really does anything stop you. If you know that's something which you want and something you need to achieve, you're going to do what it takes to make it happen.
But it's a two-part thing, right? Some folks are intrinsically motivated, so they won't let anything stop them. But for a lot of other folks, it depends on who they circle themselves with. If they have a circle of friends or associates around them who's like, hey, man, you know you're not going to get it. So they already create that defeat mentality versus if you have positivity around you, give it a shot. Let me help you with that. Then you're more inclined. Because once somebody try to help you, it comes back down to that mentor conversation. You have a certain sense of commitment, not only to achieve it, but to that individual, because that individual invested in you. So that's another thing I noticed coming from an urban area to going to less urban. You notice a lot of difference in that, because especially in the urban area, the mentality is you're just going to grow up and replace old boy on the block. And that's what that's been taught in our schools. That's been taught in the household, opposed to folks come in and say, hey, you could do way better than that, homie.
Yeah, it does play. I think even when you talk about who's in your inner circle, like inner circle of friends, I think that does play a part in, you know, if you have people within that inner circle that you see all the time, but if they're talking about things that are kind of that is not in alignment of what you're trying to achieve or what you're trying to do, you have to come to the decision and say, hey, guys are cool, but I can't, you guys doing this, I'm going this way. You have to make some changes. And I think that's going to be the case, you know, for a lot of people, you know, growing up, I think you do have to make a decision, you know, as you go through life, you know, once you have a full understanding of what it is that you want to do, what you want to do with your life. And if you're around people who are really trying to maybe hold you back or hold you down, and they're not really supportive of what you're trying to do, you may have to let them go. You know, I think that just happens.
I'll take it even further. You shouldn't have folks who would support you. You should have folks who are willing to challenge you.
Oh, yeah.
Why get complacent?
Right. Absolutely. This is good stuff, man. This is good stuff. You know, we could have had a whole nother episode just on that alone.
But you haven't got my sip of my Guinness cup, so now I'm rolling now.
but this is good, man. I definitely enjoyed the conversation with you. And, you know, we need to have you on for later episodes. So, don't be a stranger. Gotta keep coming back.
Absolutely. I'll definitely keep coming back in it, because your viewers need to know that the Air Force can make a career for you, right? Like, you just commit a few years, you get your education, we give you your certification. And on top of that, you could also get free civilian certifications. Look at me. I got 3 civilian professional certifications that I didn't pay a dime for, all through the United States Air Force. Not only are you leaving with a job certification, a skill set, but you're also leaving with leadership experience, team dynamics experience, project management experience, and you get that nice little stank on you that you serve the military. I had to throw my pitch in there.
Shameless plug, huh? Nah, good stuff, man. Good stuff, man. Yeah, it was like, Cade, it was definitely a pleasure, man. Thank you again for coming to the Cyber Coffee Hour.
Hey, I'm honored to be invited, brother.
All right, man. That's all for this episode. Thank you, everyone, and see you on the next one. Peace.